Hey, everybody. How do you deal with a controversial topic? Do you run from it? Do you believe the smears? Do you ignore it? Do you engage in the suppression of it? Or do you confront it directly? Well, I've been really curious about the topic of vaccines. We had Bobby Kennedy Jr. in our show over the summer. We've been told that everyone has to get vaccinated always and never ask any questions about it. I remember some reporter came up to me and he said that, Charlie, are you going to have more people from the disinformation dozen on your show? And it was this list that Biden put forward trying to say that all these people are harming medicine as we know it. And I didn't respond because he's a lunatic. And the more the media says we can't talk about an issue, the more interested I get. So our guest today is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. She is known as probably one of the leading vaccine critics in the country. I was at a Clay Clark event. She was there. She said some things that made sense. And I had a ton of questions. So I decided to invite her on the show and ask her questions. She believes that children should receive zero vaccines. I don't know what I believe on that, to be honest. I'm open-minded. I'm looking at this as a journalist. And that's my obligation to all of you. And so I asked her about polio, smallpox, measles, mumps, rubella. I asked her about vaccine technology, and I give her an opportunity to explain her viewpoint. And I know a lot of you are curious about this topic, and you want to hear it in an unfiltered, fair way. And I felt an obligation to bring that to all of you. And if you want to support our show, you can do so at charliekirk.com/support. I can guarantee you this. The corporate media is not having Dr. Sherry Tenpenny on anytime soon. We're going to get hit by all the major propagandist, Operation Mockingbird, corporate media types. I don't care. So I know what I believe, and I also know what I don't believe, and I know what I'm interested in and what I'm curious in. Dr. Tenpenny said something that prompted me inviting her onto my show. She said, we have the most vaccinated generation in history and the sickest generation in history. And that got me thinking. Is there a correlation? Is there a causation? I don't know, but it's worth exploring, isn't it? Not suppressing or choking dissident voices. And that's what we do on this show. Text this episode to your friends. I'd love your feedback on it. freedom@charliekirk.com. I ask her very honest questions because this is a new topic for me. And I know that you guys want to get to the bottom of this. Get involved with Turning Point USA, tpusa.com, where we operate and exist to help educate future generations, make sure your children live in a free country and pass down American values to where it matters most. TPUSA.com, TPUSA.com. All right, everybody, buckle up. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is here. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Charlie Kirk Show. With us today, a lot of people requested us to have this guest, and I'm so thrilled to be able to sit face-to-face and have a chat. Dr. Tenpenny, welcome to the Charlie Kirk Show.
Thank you so much, Charlie. It's my pleasure to be here.
So why don't you introduce yourself to our audience, and then we can go from there.
Okay. Well, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. We were just talking about how great Cleveland is. My first career, I was board-certified in emergency medicine and director of a Level 2 trauma center for 12 years. I moved to Cleveland in 1996, opened my integrative health center. We now have 21 employees. We've had patients there from all 50 states and about 18 countries to get well and get off their pharmaceutical drugs.
Well, I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
And so you have your own health clinic.
We do. And I got involved with the becoming an avid educator about vaccine problems. In September of 2000, I went to the National Vaccine Information Center meeting in Washington, D.C. And I came home and said, why did I miss this? How could I not know that there were problems with vaccines? So I started looking at the CDC documents and at the pediatric infectious disease journals and all the peer-reviewed literature. And over the last 21 years, I can solidly say vaccines are not safe They've never been proved to be effective. They definitely cause harm. And then after doing this for so long, when COVID and COVID shots all came along, it was a natural extension of the research and everything I've been doing over the last 20 years to start looking at the problems involved with this entire scamdemic.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I come in. I've never really taken much of an interest in the vaccine topic until recently, to be honest. A lot going on in the world, as you probably have noticed. And all of a sudden, there was this whole conversation around that we need to inoculate ourselves against a virus that I felt perfectly confident that I was going to be able to get through with treatments and a healthy lifestyle. And I made a statement back in November of 2020 at a church, my friend Greg Farrington's church, that I wasn't going to take the vaccine. And I got attacked from every single media outlet imaginable. So well, that's weird. It feels as if I'm getting attacked like when I say something against any other sort of group, right? I said, this is awfully coordinated. And so I got super curious. And again, I don't come at this from any sort of expertise, just someone that has kind of looked at things around me and I'm trying to learn. So let's just kind of start with some of the things that you said. I know very little about this topic. I'm super curious. I know more about the COVID vaccine and that than just kind of the topic of vaccines in general. What would you say is the case against vaccines? You said they're not safe. They definitely cause harm. You know, dive into that.
Well, they've definitely not been safe. Safety studies in any of the vaccines, whether they're the childhood vaccines, adult vaccines, and for sure the COVID vaccine, are very short term. They are most of them are 14 to 21 days at most. And long-term consequences of any shot, like autoimmune diseases, cardiovascular problems, neurological problems, take weeks to months to develop. So they're released to the market. And in the clinical trials, they're only tested on very healthy people. Yet when they are approved for use, they are advocated for everyone, including the sickest people. So they've never been tested on sick people or sick children. And so that is a big safety issue. The other thing is the word efficacy, because in scientific research in vaccines, efficacy, if you look up the definition of efficacy in Webster's, it says that the intent to do, they do what they are intended to do. So vaccines are intended to create an antibody. So they are effective in that they create an antibody. But we as consumers and as the general population assume that effective means that it keeps you from getting sick, and they don't. You can get a flu shot and still get the flu. You get the COVID shot, you definitely can still get COVID, because most people are getting sick from that. And we actually know the mechanisms of why. And so they're not effective in terms of how the general population defines that word. They are effective that they create an antibody, but effective and protection are not synonyms.
So let's take mumps or measles, yeah, for example. Do you think it's effective against those viruses?
It doesn't keep you from getting those infections. You can get the shot and still get the infection. We know that most recently, you know, there's been two really big outbreaks of mumps in maybe the last 5 to 7 years. One was in Iowa amongst college students, and they found out that all of those college students that contracted the mumps had at least 2, if not 3 MMR vaccines. There was a big outbreak of mumps on fully vaccinated Navy ship, and everybody had had at least 1, if not 2 mumps vaccines. So that just makes the point that you can get the shot and still contract the infection.
So the argument, the other side, I guess you would say, is they point to the Orthodox community in New York. You've probably heard this argument, where before there was like 2 cases of mumps or measles. I get them interchanged, but and now there was a huge outbreak, and obviously Bill de Blasio went on his whole kind of tirade saying this is because they're all unvaccinated. I mean, just kind of looking at it, in the 1960s, mumps was rather, well, widespread. Now it's very rare. Do you think the vaccine had anything to do with kind of flattening that curve?
It may flatten the curve, but what was the trade-off? You know, when we flattened the curve on measles, which had people that had there was a very high incidence rate of measles in the 60s and in the 1960s. And then when we decided we were going to mass vaccinate people against measles, we dropped the infection rate, but we exchanged it for asthma, allergies, eczema, ADD, ADHD, insulin-dependent diabetes, neurological problems, autoimmune conditions, and yes, autism, which is the far end of the autoimmune things that are happening inside of the brain. So what is the trade-off? A mild infection that for the vast majority of people, it lasts 7 to 10 days, and then they have a literal lifetime of immunity because it's a natural infection. Or do we drop the infection rate for one or two deaths? Because here's a really interesting statistic, Charlie, that I think you'd like to know, that prior to when the measles vaccine became widely available in 1963, the year before the measles vaccine came on the market, the death rate from measles was 1 to 2 per million. It was negligible. It barely ever happened. And the people that actually died from measles actually had underlying conditions. And now we may have lowered the incidence rates of measles, but we have the sickest generations of children ever. We have more children that are on long-term drugs. We have more children that are on multiple medications. So what has been the trade-off of lowering an infection and creating long-term disabled children?
I think that's really interesting. And so I try to, on this topic, just try to see all different sides, because I grew up in a world that vaccines were not questioned. You just kind of take them, and that's just what you do. Suburbs of Chicago, especially, as you could imagine. You know, you kind of know the type of community. And so I was just watching a clip the other day of Bill Gates. I try not to do that. And he says, look, he said, the reason why people don't want to take the vaccines, this was years ago, it's because we're a victim of our own success. You've probably heard this from the vaccine lobby at some point, that we've basically eradicated some of these viruses and diseases. Therefore, people don't think they're that big of an issue. And so he says measles, or he said mumps or whatever. And so I was curious, and I said, how big of a deal was this in the 60s and 70s? And mind you, a couple years ago, I probably wouldn't have gone to that next layer to ask that question. And you're right. Very few people died of measles and mumps. They used to have measles parties.
And chickenpox parties.
Which the chickenpox one is the most interesting one, because I had chickenpox growing up, and never did my parents or anyone think that I was going to die.
Right, exactly.
I thought I was very annoyed by the itching reaction.
Sure.
But having chickenpox growing up, and so then I went a step deeper and I was super curious. A chickenpox vaccine is widely pushed now in certain communities, and only 90% effective. You would know better.
Not even the breakthrough on chickenpox is very, very high. And that's why they decided, well, it wasn't working to give one chickenpox vaccine, so now we'll just give another one. And that's kind of what they do. I mean, do we ever have an endpoint of tolerance? Meaning, if we drop the incidence rate of these infections down to where it's a negligible rate, I mean, one or two kids pop up here and there with measles, mumps, chickenpox, you know, pertussis, things like that. When do we stop? When do we decide that we've eradicated this viral infection down to the point that we can have a couple of kids here and there to get these shots? Do we need to mass vaccinate children with now 72 doses of vaccines by the time they are in high school, and multiple doses of, when do we decide that it's enough? We will never see an eradication to where we have zero cases of measles, zero mumps, zero chickenpox, and all those things. It's never going to happen, because the life cycle of the virus is about every 4 years. We're going to see an outbreak of these viruses every 4 years or so, irrespective of the vaccination rate. We see that in pertussis. We know that there's breakthroughs in pertussis, but it's a cash cow for the pharmaceutical industry. You know, think about it. If your business had 4 million guaranteed, government-guaranteed customers every single year, because the birth rate of kids in this country is about 4 million per year, and in those childhood vaccines, you know, there are about 12 different vaccines that they get multiple doses of by the time they start kindergarten. If your business had 4 million government guaranteed customers that had to buy multiple doses of your product every single year, when would you decide, well, we don't need to do this anymore? Like, never, right? Never. So it's and I've long said that the childhood vaccination schedule, it is the economic loss leader for the pharmaceutical industry, because there's going to be 5 to maybe 15% of those children that are going to end up with long-term chronic disease. They're going to end up with asthma, allergies, eczema, ADD, seizure disorders, autoimmune diseases, and all of those things, which drives the subspecialists going to the doctor, more tests, more pharmaceutical drugs, that they become customers for life. And so if you took out the vaccination schedule, because if you look at fully unvaccinated kids, they're healthy. They rarely, if ever, get sick. There are no chronic medications. They have no long-term disabilities. Now, if suddenly your 4 million customers go to 100,000, what would that do to your bottom line? So in my opinion, and after looking at this for more than 20 years, the vaccination schedule the pediatric vaccination schedule is the economic driver of the pharmaceutical industry to make sure that you've got customers for life on their long-term chronic daily medications.
So when I ask some of the vaccine company advocates or whatever you want to call them, just kind of the defenders of the status quo about this.
That's a good way to say that.
So that's a nice way to put it. And some of the people haven't just thought very deeply about this. And again, I'm just trying to kind of make sense of all this. They say the problem with your argument, the problem with Bobby Kennedy's argument, the problem they say is the old causation and correlation argument. I'm sure you've encountered this before. And this is their immediate reaction. And this is their strongest argument, in the sense that it's hard for me to even respond to it, because I just ask a question. They say, oh, no. Just because you saw all these people with asthma and all these issues doesn't mean it was vaccines. They say it's because we weren't diagnosing them before. They say it was other environmental factors. They say it could be food. It could be nutrition.
It's because they want to blame anything but the vaccine. And if you ever notice those arguments, no matter how long the list of the counter is, they never even put into that list, perhaps it was the vaccine on at least some of those kids. It's never even included in their argument.
That's totally right. And so I guess my question for you, said something that really interested me. You say you take a group of unvaccinated kids. Have there been studies that you would methodologically agree with done properly that kind of do that sort of study of vaccinated versus unvaccinated kids?
There have been two studies that have come out. One was a phone survey of just and the CDC said, well, that wasn't valid because phone surveys aren't valid, except they do them all the time. So, you know, this phone survey that was asking about how many vaccines have you had. And the end of that study was that they showed that if I remember correctly, this was a while ago. So it was somewhere around 14% of the people in that study, there was a 14% increase of asthma and allergies in the vaccinated population versus the unvaccinated population. Then there was a couple of other studies that were done, really well-designed long-term studies, to look at the number of medications that unvaccinated children were taking as opposed to the number of medications that vaccinated children were taking. And that's a really good study because it's a real number. I mean, you can't like take in the variables about like what your food is like, if you have animals in the house. I mean, because that's a variable. But the number of medications that children are taking that are fully vaccinated versus completely unvaccinated. I mean, the fully vaccinated children in that particular study was reaching 2 to 3 to 4, when the unvaccinated was 1 or 0. And then they pulled the study and told them that it was unethical to do a study of vaccinated versus unvaccinated because they claimed that an unvaccinated child is being ill, is being mistreated, because unvaccinated children, you're withholding a known treatment of benefit from a child. So you're putting that child, that unvaccinated child, at risk. So they've got every excuse underneath the sun to not do this, and they won't fund it. I mean, and the CDC, last time I looked, had like a $16 or $18 billion a year annual budget, and that was before COVID. And it's like, you mean you can't fund a study of vaccinated versus unvaccinated kids to see if maybe the vaccine is really much better? Maybe those kids are much healthier. Maybe there are problems. But here's the thing, Charlie, in research, you can't find what you're not looking for. And they never go and fund things to research something they don't want to know the answer to. Because what if it all blew up? What if it showed that all of the unvaccinated kids were much healthier, on much fewer medications, they did better in school, their brains worked better, they weren't on ADD and ADHD medications compared to a fully vaccinated population? It would implode the entire pharmaceutical industry. It would drop it like a rock.
Maybe part of the whole nonsense of this Fauci virus deal is more people are thinking about this. So you say 72 doses that a child receives from the time they're born to when exactly?
About 18. into college, because when you get into college, they're talking about meningitis vaccines,
hepatitis
Gardasil.
B,
you know, hepatitis B starts at birth. You know, they start giving it within hours of birth.
Yeah, in case your kids, you know, sexually active at age 8 or doing heroin.
Right, exactly.
That's the only way you can get hepatitis
right,
B, right?
Exactly.
Needles or sex.
Right. You know, when it's interesting about hepatitis B, because when they first started using hepatitis B at birth was in 1991. And at that point in time, there were actually 14,000 cases of hepatitis B in the entire country of kids under the age of 14. So out of 40 million kids, there were like 14,000 cases, and most of them were in parents that had hepatitis B. And why did we start deciding that we were going to give hepatitis B at birth? Well, because hepatitis B is endemic in the population in Southeast Asia. Exactly. Why did we do that? That was why. And when we started giving hepatitis B at birth, Congress actually had a hearing and said, where's your data? Where's your studies that have shown that this is safe and not going to mess up developmental and all these different things in these kids? And the pharmaceutical industry said to Congress, we don't have any of that. We tested the hepatitis B vaccine on 5 and 7 year old kids. They said, so that automatically makes it okay for a neonate 1 or 2 or 3 days old? Yep. And Congress said, go back and investigate that further, which they never did. And that started in 1991.
So the vaccine that started all this, obviously, was polio. That was the one that got written up everywhere. Jonas Salk, I'm sure you get asked about this a lot.
And smallpox. The smallpox vaccine.
Yeah. Can you talk about those two? Do you think that? Let's just isolate those two. Do you think parents should still give those? And if not, why? Do you think it was a good thing for humanity that technology was developed and deployed?
Well, smallpox vaccine, we stopped giving it to the general population in 1972 because it was causing more side effects and more long-term complications. And the incidence rate of smallpox globally had dropped almost to zero. In fact, in the early 1900s, we went from very virulent smallpox that caused historically things like when they put the blankets and gave them to the Indians and stuff like that. That was in the 1800s. And the virus was in the community and rather burned itself out. So after the early 1900s, smallpox was like a couple little lumps and bumps on your skin. It wasn't a big virulent infection. But we continued to vaccinate because the Jenner's vaccine actually became on the market in 1800 and 1801, was the first smallpox vaccines delivered in the United States. And so by 1972, we decided that the incidence of smallpox worldwide was almost negligible. So they actually fabricated this thing and said it was all about the vaccine. But really less than 10% of the global population had ever been vaccinated with a smallpox vaccine. And the numbers of gangrene and loss of limbs and all these things that were happening from the shot, they actually created, it's very interesting history, actually. We don't have time to go over all of it, but it's very interesting how they kind of created this whole thing that, oh, celebrated the smallpox vaccine, eradicated smallpox, which when you really read the history, it really did not. So we stopped giving the smallpox vaccine in 1972. We continued to give it to the military into the 1990s for no reason other than we just did. And the same thing with the polio vaccine. You know, the peak of polio was in 1954, and that's when the vaccine was released. We still give children today 4 doses of polio vaccine here in the United States, even though polio has, the World Health Organization has declared the Western Hemisphere, the entire Western Hemisphere, polio-free since 1994. But yet we still continue to give kids 4 doses of polio to protect against a virus that doesn't even exist.
So their argument would be, we give it because we don't want to reintroduce it because we eradicated it because of
the vaccine. But if something doesn't exist, what do I need to protect? If this water bottle no longer existed, it just didn't exist, it was gone, why do I have to keep taking something to protect me against that water bottle?
Yeah, I guess their argument would be it could come from a third world country, or there could be a strain available somewhere. And again, I don't know how transmission of polio, you could tell me. Is it a viral?
It's a viral illness that we started using it first started with the oral drops, in the little sugar cube that you put in your mouth. That was in the 50s. And then we were seeing, the only cases of polio we were seeing in this country was induced by the vaccine. Like I took a polio little sugar cube, it went out in my stool and my urine, and downstream you got exposed and you got polio. That was what was happening. So in our country, we went away from the oral polio vaccine and went to the injectable polio vaccine in about 2000. We haven't used the oral polio vaccine for that long, but oral polio vaccines, still given as the little drops under the tongue, are still used in third world countries. And they know absolutely that they are still seeing cases of polio, but it's coming from the vaccine. It's not wild type polio.
So do you think Jonas Salk and all of that kind of celebration of him and the introduction of polio, the polio vaccine, was that a positive thing? Was that a good thing? Or do you think that there's more history to that?
There's a lot more history to that. They've written lots of books on that, actually.
Well, they have the Jonas Salk Institute, right? He is considered to be in the pantheon of great 20th century figures. Is that a correct characterization of his?
Well, I don't know. They'd probably put Fauci in that bucket too.
Not if I had anything to say about it. So that's why I'm asking. I'm not a Jonas Salk expert by any, you know.
Yeah. The whole history of the entire vaccine industry is really sordid, and the pro-vaccine people don't know the history. And the more you try to tell them, the more it creates cognitive dissonance in their brain, and they just don't want to hear it.
How many kids were dying of polio at its peak in 1954?
Not many. Now, the dying of polio was different than experiencing
right.
the polio of the limb problem.
Now, here's almost being paralyzed.
But
right,
here's that, something yeah. that a little historical fact that not many people know. You know, every time we see like pictures of polio, we think March of Dimes, you know, the kids in braces, mm-hmm. and we think about kids on ventilators. And there's one picture that shows all these bassinet-sized things that was supposed to be a polio ward.
And also barbaric chamber, right?
Right. The iron lung.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Which was the precursor to modern day ventilators.
Okay.
So I wanted to see how many people were actually on iron lungs. And I spent months actually looking for this information. You would think that would be readily available somewhere, right? I actually even went to the History of Medicine Museum in Baltimore and actually got permission to go into the basement to see if I could actually find the number of people who were on iron lungs, which was supposed to be the worst type of polio that had stopped your breathing. I investigated manufacturers of iron lung machines. I went to all kinds of places to try to find the data. And when I finally found it, like 3 or 4 years later, there were about 1,200 people in the entire country that were on iron lungs. I don't know. Doesn't seem like a horrible. I mean, yes. I mean, I never want to minimize a death or make it sound like it was negligible. But when you've got a population in the country of over 200 million and you have 1,200 people on an iron lung machine, 1,200 to 1,500 people, I think more people died in car accidents. And that we didn't want to do something to eliminate cars.
Yeah, I mean, the telling from the greatest generation, in my grandmother's generation, that they did think back and they were like, polio was a problem. There was angst and unease about it. How much of that was media induced or whatever, I don't know. That's a question. However, for your argument, and I'm sure you have to talk about it all the time, the polio topic is a sticking point. That is, in a lot of ways, what built Western consensus behind vaccine technology.
Well, yes, and the propaganda that went on behind it is, I mean, you could write 3 books about that. And actually, whenever you meet someone who really is kind of new to the topic, or they because there's more people having kids all the time. So
yeah,
they become,
I'm new to it. I'm just curious, right?
Right. So it always starts with what about smallpox and what about polio? So I've created 2 courses actually about it that if you go to, I mean, one of our websites is learning4you.org, learning the number 4, Y-O-U, learningforyou.org. And there's 2 hours of courses in there each about smallpox and polio that give the different perspective and give all the references and all the technology and all these things to see. It's like a lot of things, Charlie. You know, when you get the media involved with it, that as the propaganda arm, and as long as they say the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, and they drive the fear wheel over and over and again, like they have with this COVID shot, you know, people just, they don't dig any deeper. Just like what you had said earlier, that, you know, there was a couple things that made you dig a little deeper, but most people just, whatever's coming out of that box, that's all they need to know.
So there's 72 doses from birth to 18 years old.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's also an interestingly spiritual number. We can get into that later.
There are 17 different vaccines, multiple doses of 17 vaccines. So when you add them all up, it's right around 72.
So would you – I know you have to be careful giving medical advice, but do you think any of those are necessary?
I don't, because I look at all of the completely unvaccinated kids that we have a huge – and we have a pediatrician in our practice in Cleveland, Ohio. And when we see we have, all the unvaccinated kids, they're perfectly healthy. When we see the vaccinated kids, there's always something broken in their immune system or something. They've got food allergies, eczema. They've got all these different things. So I think it's a technology whose time has kind of come to go away, but it will never go away because it's the economic driver of the pharmaceutical industry. And like I already said, if you've got 4 million guaranteed customers every single year, it's really about the
money.
Well,
some industries can be challenged. Tobacco seemed to be untouchable for years.
Right.
And there actually were some positives.
And asbestos.
There were some positives to widespread smoking, such as we weren't obese. People died earlier because of lung cancer, no doubt. But smoking is a known appetite suppressant. No one wants to say that out loud, but it's true.
It's true.
Again, I'm not saying smoking. I think smoking's disgusting. I can't stand it. Honestly, I can't stand being around it. However, there was this corner that was turned as people stopped smoking. They started eating more, and the fast food industry benefited tremendously from it. So, but tobacco, I think, was an industry that needed to be challenged, and rightfully so. I think that they preyed on the good meaning intentions of millions of people, especially young people. So some industries can be disrupted, but unfortunately it gets transferred, right? It goes from
right.
You stop doing cigarettes and then KFC and McDonald's and Taco Bell kind of, or
yeah,
Budweiser.
That's a good analogy.
Michelob Ultra kind of fill the place. So, 17 different vaccines. So let me ask you this question. There's a lot of new parents that listen to this and they're very, very confused about this topic. So we'll talk about this as much as we can. At the end, you can kind of give some resources. You already did, learning4u.org. Some parents say, I had no say. My kid was born and they said they had to be vaccinated. Is that true? Does a parent have a say?
Not as much as they used to have. I mean, now that it's actually a lot of hospitals actually hold young parents hostage and say, we're not going to release your child from the hospital until they get a hepatitis B vaccine. And we know that they've had a visit from a pediatrician and the pediatrician is actually all pushing the vaccines. See what I always would say, Charlie, and I would say to your audience, which I know is a younger audience, just investigate before you vaccinate. The only reason that they set up the pediatric schedule like they did at 4 and 6 months in 1 year, where they get like 7 to 9 doses of vaccines in 1 day, the reason that that was set up is for doctor convenience and for the sake of your insurance. Well, baby visits are at 2, 4, and 6 months. There's nothing magical about that. And it's interesting that ever since this COVID thing has happened, parents, are staying at home. They're working from home now. They don't go to the doctor, and they've found that their kids now are a year old and they're unvaccinated because they just never got around to going to the pediatrician. And guess what? They didn't die. And guess what? They're healthy. They don't have any other underlying things. And I think that that's been a big eye-opener for young parents. Suddenly, they're questioning the COVID shot, as they should, which like is a rollover into them start at least investigating all the other shots. Then they're going, well, maybe these aren't really necessary either. And when they start looking at the ingredients inside of those shots, serum, cow blood, chicken parts, dog kidney cells, insect cells, mercury, tons of aluminum, almost 13,000 micrograms of aluminum if you get the full schedule. And then you look at the cells from aborted fetal tissue that are in the rubella shot, the chickenpox vaccine, and the shingles shot in adults. I mean, they start looking at these ingredients and they go, do I really want this injected in my child? Why didn't anybody tell me these things? And so now that they're investigating, they're like, well, maybe these things aren't so necessary. And so, You were talking about transmuting like different things that they changed, like from cigarettes to fast food. I think the COVID shot and the challenges that that's had, and people are saying, no, I don't want an experimental genetic modification technology that's going to permanently and irreversibly change my God-given genes and my God-given genetics. I don't want that in my body. Well, maybe I don't want bovine fetal cow serum in my children either. And so I think
I've said that before.
So the vaccination rate in the childhood schedule is way down. We don't see any big upticks in a big epidemics of things.
So I've said before that there's all these animal parts and defenders of the status quo say that's not true.
Really? Go read your own package inserts.
So let me just so I can understand. There are ingredients in the vaccine that are parents are able to look at them or sign off on them. Does every vaccine have
all
these animal parts in them?
Well,
and the aluminum.
Almost all of them have aluminum. The flu shots still have multi-dose vials of influenza vaccines still have mercury in them. The aborted fetal cell tissues comes in rubella, which is part of MMR. It's hepatitis A, chickenpox, and the shingles vaccine. And so we were talking about chickenpox earlier. I mean, these ingredients, they're there. They've been there forever. I mean, ever since the beginning. I mean, we had hepatitis B at birth that started in 1991. We had the Hib vaccine that started in 91. Then we had chickenpox that started in 95. We've had pertussis vaccine since the 40s. I mean, we've had all of these toxic, horrible ingredients. So you take your brand new baby, your gift from God that comes into your life, that's whole and pure. God didn't go, oh, I forgot the immune system. Hurry, vaccinate.
So let me ask you a question about this. Uh-huh. And I have no idea if this is anything that you're familiar with talking about. Do you find that C-section children have weaker immune systems?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No.
Because you do know there's a whole scientific movement that the C-section, because they don't get the last kind of part of bacteria from the mother, that there's a huge movement to try to end C-sections.
Well, they should end C-sections except for emergencies from probably a whole other bunch of reasons.
Well, tell me. I'm interested in that. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so many C-sections now, and you can get this data from all kinds of places. It's just done at doctor convenience. Mm-hmm. I'm going on vacation next week, so let's get your baby out today. You know, we don't let God's natural birth happen anymore. Now, is it a good thing that we have the C-section technology? Absolutely, because there are conditions with the cord wrapped around the neck or shoulder dystocia or things like that. You can't just fit through the birth canal. Are we glad that we can save the mother and the baby with that technology? But it's way overused, and we've known that for decades. And it's usually done at either the parent's convenience. You know, I'm tired of being pregnant. I want to go on a cruise next week. Or the doctors are going out of town, or we just schedule it so it's convenient because, oh, well, you're far enough along. Let's just do this. So I think there's lots of reasons why the whole C-section thing should be reconsidered, except for emergency needs.
It's used a lot, especially in the upper income ladder. It's almost like I get to choose my date. I get to circle it. And so the vaccination schedule, for some people, though, they email us and say, they didn't let me out of the hospital. Are there parents' rights that are available to them? Is it state by state?
It's state by state, and it's also almost hospital by hospital because, you know, different hospitals in the state of Ohio may have different rules. But they really need to – parents need to step into the place of having their birth plan in place before they ever go to the hospital. I've been a big advocate for a long time about home births, you know, having your midwife and things like that backed up. Have it at home. I mean, my business partner, 4 out of 5 of his kids were born at home, and it was like no big deal, right? And so I think that people are now not wanting to go to hospitals because as soon as you go to the hospital, you get tested for COVID and all that whole domino effect things happen. And so I believe there's going to be a resurgence of home births, mm-hmm. needs for midwives, and doing this at home instead of medicalizing birth. We need to have it like natural God-given birth.
Yeah, hospitals are not there for treatment. They can intervene in a small percentage of births where there are life-threatening
complications. Absolutely,
that's what they're trained to do. But in just kind of a very easy birth, they're like, you know, let's let's just get this done with, right?
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So I want to ask you something that you said at the beginning, which I'm interested in. You said we have the sickest generation
of
in
children.
History.
We do.
Which is so fascinating to me because we are supposed to be the most progressed. It's 2022. We have Twitter. I mean,
of course.
We're so smart, right? We have Uber, right?
Yeah.
And everyone, we have Netflix. I'm being facetious by saying, we've had all this technological advancement, allegedly, right? We're getting driverless cars. We have electric vehicles. And yet what you're saying is that, no, actually, we're sicker than ever before. Please talk about that.
Well, I think you just summed it up. We are sicker than ever before. I mean, not only from in our children, which that statistic has been published a lot. I mean, you can find that a lot of places, that we have the sickest generation of children, like, ever. And that are on, I mean, you know, think about this, Charlie. I mean, back in the 60s, you would have two or three kids in a classroom, or maybe in an entire school. I grew up in a really rural school community. We, you know, there was 101 in my graduating class, and that was a consolidation of three school districts. So I grew up in a little tiny kind of rural town in north central Ohio. And there weren't kids. There was the rare child that was on some sort of a medication. Maybe they had a seizure disorder. Maybe they had asthma, but rarely. And now today, in a classroom of 30 or 40 kids, almost every single child is on at least one medication.
How much of that do you think is vaccines and or just a overly zealous medical community that overdiagnoses? Or you think it's a little bit of both?
I think that's a good point. Overdiagnose, I don't think so. But are they too willing to just be overzealous and to just prescribe a medication as opposed to saying maybe they've got food allergies, maybe they've got environmental allergies, maybe they're allergic to the dog, and that's why they're having all of these different things. So an overzealous medical community, because the only tool in their toolbox is writing a prescription. They don't spend time with parents talking about normal developmental milestones and when do you introduce these types of foods. And let's look. I've had pediatricians. I've read published reports now where pediatricians say, yes, developing asthma at 2 is kind of a normal milestone. Really? So now they've medicalized everything. And now by 2 years of age, they've had, you know, many vaccines with all these ingredients we've talked about. And yes, are there other elements? But here's a good story for you, Charlie. Years ago, I spoke at a chiropractic association meeting in Wisconsin. And this dad came up to me on one of the breaks and he said, you could do a study of my family. He said, I have 6 children. The first 3 children were fully vaccinated with everything. Then my wife and I kind of woke up and kind of looked around. The last 3 children are completely unvaccinated. So they're the same genetics, same food, same house, same laundry detergent, same everything. He said, you would think they were from 2 completely different families. My oldest 3 kids that are completely vaccinated are kind of aggressive. They don't do as well in school. They're sick a lot. They're kind of aggressive in their personality. Our youngest 3, completely unvaccinated, get along with everybody. They're straight A students. They've never so much as had a cold. And he said, you could see distinctions, complete distinctions. And the only variable there was the vaccines.
You see that a lot?
Yes. Because what ends up happening in a lot of cases is that the first child gets fully vaccinated because parents think that's what they're supposed to do. And then they end up with all these illnesses and all these problems, and they start to investigate and they start looking around going, I'm not going to do that anymore. So then child 2, 3, and 4 are like I just described in that other family. They're completely unvaccinated, no problems whatsoever.
You said something interesting. You said that the childhood vaccinations are not going up. They're actually
going down.
They're going down.
Since COVID.
What percentage?
I don't know the answer to that.
It's enough that where it's noticeable.
It's enough
obviously.
Where it's noticeable, yeah.
The birth rate is going down. Suicides are up. Anxiety is up. Drug overdoses are up. Would you say that mass vaccination plays a role in a lot of these different things?
Of course. You know, this whole thing that we've been talking about, I mean, in the last 2 years, Charlie, I've done almost 600 interviews. I've done just between April of 21 and December of 21, I did 389 events, either live events or speaking events, either like being interviewed or having people on my own podcast. So I've talked a lot. I think I know a lot about this topic. And, you know, we talk about the myth of the mask. We know the only thing that masks do is make the person who wears them sick That's it. They don't block anything. You know, we've talked about the fraud of the PCR testing. We know about the, you know, the cycle values, cycle thresholds. We know about all they're doing is data harvesting and collecting to put in the mass databases so that they can move us into the transhumanism movement. We know that that's what the PCR testing is all about. We know about the social distancing and what a big complete nonsense that is. I mean, it's the smartest virus ever, right? It can measure 6 feet. It knows heights. It can count the number of people in the room.
And if you're protesting against George Floyd.
Absolutely. Bad deal. It knows at 10 o'clock at night is when it comes out and can hop all over everybody, right? And then, of course, the whole – I've identified – I wrote two ebooks that are available on my website. It's drtenpenny.com. The ebooks are the 40 mechanism – I did 20 mechanisms of injury of how the COVID shots can make you sick or kill you. And I did – it was bad planning on my part. I did a webinar. And it was Mother's Day weekend. And people were like, oh, do it again. So we scheduled it to do it in July. And between May and July, I found 20 more mechanisms of injury. So there are 40 different ways these COVID shots can make you sick or kill you. And both of those ebooks are available on my website. But we know that these shots are really bad and people don't want them. We think that less, you know, all the numbers that come through the propaganda machine are wrong. We don't have an absolute count on the number of people who are not vaccinated or refusing the vaccines. But we think that the unvaccinated population is more than 40%. And because they don't want it. And so because of that, people are starting to question the entire vaccine paradigm. And I think that once they start realizing their children don't need to be injected with all this toxic stuff, they're beautiful. They come from God. They're pure. You know, God gave them an incredible immune system. We don't need to medicalize their immune system.
So you are, the President of the United States calls you one of the disinformation dozen.
I love it. I wear it like a badge.
Talk about that.
Well, if
Biden, by the way.
Yeah. Get the name right.
I just want to make sure for our listeners. He says that you are one of the most 12 dangerous people. You're more dangerous than Fauci. You're more dangerous than the weed companies, which I'd love your thought on marijuana because I'm not a fan. More dangerous than Budweiser, right? More dangerous than Coors Light. You're more dangerous than the Sackler family, right?
Yeah.
No, you.
Me.
You are part of the disinformation dozen. I could talk at length about how they're going to try to criminalize medical speech very soon and how that impacts everybody.
Yeah.
Criminalize, not just censor. But how do you interpret and process the President of the United States kind of declaring war on you?
I love it because I feel like that means I'm right over the radar. I am hovering right over the target and they know it. And in all the years that I've been doing this and doing it loudly, you know, when I first got into talking out, speaking a lot about problems associated with vaccines in September of 2000 and been doing it loudly going forward, somebody gave me great advice and they said, Sherry, there's one of two ways that you really need to do this, either very quietly, one-on-one with patients in your office or as big and loud as you possibly can, and which was kind of more my personality. You know, once I know what I know, I want to share it with people. And they've never, ever been able to challenge me on the science because I only pull out information from peer-reviewed published literature. I have a personal collection of over 17,000 articles from the peer-reviewed medical literature showing problems with vaccines, either full text articles or links to abstracts to articles. And people can access that. It's free. It's called the Tenpenny Research Library. So it's like the Tenpenny it's tenpennyresearchlibrary.com. All you have to do is sign up for free, just register, and you can have access to that entire collection of problems, of articles showing problems with vaccines. So when the president of the person who calls himself president of the United States declares war on me, it's like, bring it on, baby. And we've tried for years. Charlie, we've tried for years to have a legitimate debate between pro-vaccine people and those of us that are the disinformation dozen. and we actually had the closest that we had this done. It was about maybe 2018. We're going to set this up in Georgia. We invited very pro-vaccine, highly credentialed people from Emory and the CDC to come. And you sit on this side of the stage. And me and Dr. Larry Pilevsky and Dr., you know, Lee Merritt and we'll sit on the other side of the stage. You'll get questions in advance that you'll be able to prepare your answer in advance. There'll be no gotcha questions. And we hired a very professional local television guy to be the moderator. So there would be no, it would just be my answers, versus their answers, our answers versus their answers, and have it highly publicized. It was going to be about 2 hours, and then let the people decide. So we all decided to go to Georgia. We were ready to do this debate. There was like six people on the disinformation side and six people on their side. And 3 days before the event was supposed to occur, they all pulled out because their discussion was, we can't have a debate with these people because then we will give credibility to the fact that there's something worth debating. And so every time that we have tried to like, come on, bring it on. Let's go have a conversation. Your stuff versus my stuff. They refuse to do it. And that's their excuse, that if we debate it, we're giving it credibility that there's something worth debating. And of course, there's something. If I've got 17,000 articles pulled from peer-reviewed medical literature, like the New England Journal and JAMA and, you know, British Medical Journal and all these different things published in their studies that they should know about, and they aren't willing to just have a conversation about what's your beliefs, show us your science, we'll talk about our beliefs, we'll show you our science, and then let the people decide. It's happened every time. We've tried to set that up about 4 times. Most recently was a big deal, and they canceled the event.
So for people that are heavily vaccinated, like I am growing up, what can you do? Because it sounds, you know, if you're right, you're going to have all these health problems. What can a vaccinated person do? Because that obviously has to be part of your outreach too, right?
Well, partly there's two answers to that. For one thing, you know, once you're vaccinated, you can't unvaccinate. It's not like I can stick a needle in you and go and pull it back out of your system. So once you are vaccinated, you cannot unvaccinate. And that's why I would encourage your young audience, the people that listen to you and follow you, please investigate before you vaccinate. Know what's coming through the needle. Know the potential side effects. And understand what measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox really is and how you can treat it naturally at home. Like everybody in my generation just had all those infections. It was not a big deal.
And that was prior to some of the treatments that have now been developed.
Well, no, it was like, you know, you let the infection run its course.
Well, I'm agreeing with you, meaning that there's more widespread magnesium, zinc.
Yeah, exactly.
Homeopathic doctors, intravenous therapy, ozone therapy.
Herbal things.
Like these are things that are now more widespread
than
in the 1960s.
Yes, but I'm also saying that, you know, I'm a lot older than I look. And I'm saying that, you know, people, all these people in my generation, you know, 50 and above generation, we had all these infections and recovered from them.
That's not going to give people comfort.
Well, but we all lived. You don't see a bunch of dead people. And yet there are, again, I will say, yes, there are other things that parents feel like they need to do something. And so there are homeopathy, there's herbal products.
That's what I'm trying to create a bridge, because just telling a parent that your kids is going to get mumps, you're going to lose some people.
But here's part of what I'm saying is, like, if you did just a little bit of reading, just a little bit, even on your phone, and find out what mumps really was, maybe you wouldn't be so terrified of it. And if your kid got mumps, it wouldn't be such a big deal. Well, so and if they did, you can take
these things. If you Google mumps, the first picture that shows up is a poor six-year-old with a massive gland.
And it's the only picture they have of that. Right?
I don't know. You tell me.
It is. So I'm just saying, investigate before you vaccinate. Know what mumps really is. If it's just a swollen big bunch of glands, is that so terrifying?
Well, the question is it permanent? Right?
No, that would be, it's not permanent. It goes away in 7 to 10 days with a lifetime of immunity, as opposed to artificial immunity that you get from the shots. But I'm just saying, you need to just investigate. Just look a little bit deeper. Understand what you can do in terms of home remedies. Can you use, you know, lavender oil, and can you use different types of things? But the most important thing is keep your child healthy in terms of keeping them away from white sugar, white flour, you know, junk food, you know, all those different things. And you know, like I've got parents in our practice that have never given their children sugar ever. If they want a treat, they get a piece of fruit. They get something with honey. They've never adopted the acquired taste of something sweet like that comes from white sugar.
Yeah. Sugar and fat.
Did you ever read the book? You know, Mendelsohn wrote this book back in the 50s, How to Raise a Healthy Child in Spite of Your Pediatrician.
No, I've not read that.
Well, maybe some of your audience have read it. It's been around for a long time. How to Raise a Healthy Child in Spite of Your Pediatrician. And I think that that's just a little bit of investigation. And then decide. And if parents are really terrified of polio, well, then at least you should be able to pick and choose. You don't have to get the entire boatload of vaccines. If they're like, well, wait a minute, polio hasn't been in the Western Hemisphere since since 1994. Maybe I don't want to get four of those shots.
Yeah, and so if I work for Pfizer or AstraZeneca or Moderna or Johnson & Johnson, which I don't, they'd say, okay, if we don't keep up the fight against polio and keep vaccinating, then 20 years from now, because of people like you, polio is going to come back.
Is there any proof of that?
That's what they're going to say. They're going to say polio existed before and thanks to us, it's gone. That's basically – that's their –
propaganda.
Shtick.
Their shtick, exactly. That's what it is, exactly like that.
And so – and parents find that to be persuasive. Some do.
Some do, and most – and a lot don't. In fact, before we started, there was a several studies that came out in the 1617 era that showed that more than 60% of parents were seriously questioning the pediatric childhood schedule. Why do they even pro-vaccine parents, even parents that were willing to get their child vaccinated, they were like, can I give them one at a time? Can I spread them out? Do I have to get six on the same day? Do I have to get four doses of polio vaccine for it to be effective? Can I just get one or two? You know, and so they started making that. So parents were starting to question, do I need to get this entire thing? And so part of when parents were questioning that, what the pharmaceutical industry response to that was making combination vaccines. So they would have four or five vaccines in one shot. So instead of the nurse bringing in five needles, they'd bring in one shot, in the parent, and they would say, oh, it's just one shot. And unless the parents investigated it, they didn't realize they were getting five shots in one.
Yeah, I mean, that's like putting a whole bottle of Jack Daniels in one glass. It's just one shot. Come on.
Exactly.
It's a bigger amount. Okay, so you mentioned autism.
Yeah.
So just for some of our listeners, just to define our terms, what is autism? And
it's brain inflammation. And there's various degrees of it. It's not a one size fits all. You can be mildly on the spectrum, or you can be so severe that you can't speak, talk, you'll always wear a helmet. And when you're 27 years old, you'll still be in a diaper. I mean, it's brain inflammation is what autism is.
And that can be diagnosed through just – you could see it basically is what you're saying through an X-ray or CAT scan or whatever.
No. It's – you would have to do a PET scan, which okay. They don't do that. It's diagnosed by behavior analysis.
So autism is increasing. 1 in 33, is that about right?
That's about right. Okay. Stephanie Senna from MIT, you know, has done some projections and saying that if we stay on the same rate of autism, that by the year 2035, I think she said, or maybe 2032, but in that 50% of all children will be on the autism spectrum. And of that 50%, the vast majority will be boys. For some reason, boys are more susceptible to the brain injury that comes.
So they... Again, they'll go back. They'll say it's not because of the vaccine. It's disproven.
It's not disproven. I mean, there are hundreds of articles that are published about it. Even Dr. Andy Wakefield, who they continue to chastise him. That was 20-some years ago when he published that case report saying perhaps we need to investigate this further. And instead, that was taken out of context. And he was made the villain of the entire vaccine industry. I mean, it was like 2,100 mainstream articles about him, like in a matter of 48 hours. He was on after he was on Anderson Cooper and all this stuff, right? So they still use that disparaged physician who said that there was any connection between MMR and autism. They drag Andy around every once in a while, but that was 20 years ago. Do you really think that maybe there have been more research studies and more things that have been published since that time? The answer is yes, but they never talk about those.
Yeah, it's this kind of very frustrating loop, I'm sure, that you're in, because no one wants to study it as deeply as you think they should, right? And then there's all these other side effects. They say it's other things. For example, with autism, they say, well, we're just diagnosing it now. We didn't even know what it was.
Where are the adult autistic people that are wearing helmets and banging their head if it was just better diagnosis?
Yeah, so
we don't see any we don't see any older people on that spectrum because they didn't get all these doses.
And
of
if
vaccines.
You did, it would probably be fetal alcohol syndrome. You know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Was that the correct medical term, where there wasn't as much information about drinking while pregnant? Is that correct? That was probably the leader of brain injury or mental, incapacitation of that generation.
Probably. There was a lot of things. And that was, in the 50s and the 40s when women started smoking, when we were talking about smoking
while
a little bit earlier, while pregnant and things like that. So
had a disastrous
effect.
So
we've come kind of full circle to a lot of different things about the issues with these childhood shots. I'd really like to spend the last few minutes while we're together more on the COVID shot and what we want to do.
Yeah, the reason I haven't focused on that is we've done a ton of guests on that.
Oh, okay.
And no, but I want you to talk about it. I've been dodging it, obviously. Our other guests have been hesitant to talk where we spent the last hour.
Oh, cool.
So you've kind of helped fill that in. But please, COVID shot.
Well, I just want to say that, you know, because to me, I've been doing this talk. I mean, I did this talk at, Clay Clark's event this weekend. And the talk that I've been doing around the country is the spiritual ramifications of the COVID shot. And that's really heavy on my heart. You know, God put that on my heart. And I've been doing that pretty full steam ahead. So it's a little different take on just like the messenger RNA and all the shots of maybe some of your other guests. Because I really believe that there's strong ramifications of what this COVID shot does to our genetics as a genetic modification technology, that our God-given genes, that there's one of us. You know, when your dad's sperm and your mom's egg came together and God said, spark of life, there's never been another one of you ever, and there won't be in the future. It's God's gift to us, and Yahweh is actually written right across of our genes in the Hebrew language, in the Hebrew letters. And these COVID shots are actually going in and snipping those sulfide bonds and removing Yahweh from our genes. And actually, when you do all the spiritual, you know, biblical texts and saying, you know, our body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, and we volunteer to contaminate it, I think that that's a really, really big deal. And I think that those people who've taken the shot and start looking around at all the different ramifications of that, it's going to become a spiritual revival, Charlie, and you know, about that people need to get back to God, and because they got vaccinated for one of two reasons, either out of fear or convenience. Now, fear, they should have taken to the Lord in prayer. They should have read there's over 100 verses in the Bible that say fear not. And I kind of say that if God repeats himself that many times, it's probably important.
365, do not be afraid, one for every day.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it doesn't say fear not, but there's lots of time. There are 365 fear-based scriptures, but they don't all say fear not. I'm actually writing a book on that right now. So,
well, then I'll have to go tell a theologian he's wrong.
Well, no, I've got the list.
Oh, okay.
But when you actually look at the list at the 365, it's more about, it's bigger than that. So it's just like the personal fear not, you know, the personal fear nots. So either you should have prayed about it and said, Lord, take this fear away from me. I trust in you for my health or for convenience. I want to go on a cruise. I want to, you know, go to the House of Blues. I want to. And once the people started really kind of realizing, when you start seeing people that are seriously injured, I mean, the VAERS database, are you familiar with the
Vaccine
VAERS?
Adverse Event Reporting System.
Good job.
Yeah.
You know, the last time I looked, 21,000 deaths and more than a million.
Probably low.
And more than a million reported adverse events. And that was as of December 24th.
It's probably low. Yeah.
And that's 1%, right?
Yeah.
So I believe that when people start seeing that they really need to, you know, they chose poorly. And that choice has led to serious complications, and it should lead them back to God.
How could people follow you and support you?
Well, we have a new website because we're raising money for a new healthcare system. I mean, what we're doing is I've got some great ideas. We've got a great team that we're put together because everybody's so sick of the healthcare system the way that it is. And so we want to help be part of developing a whole new healthcare system going forward takes people that the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry don't tell you the type of care that you need to do. You get to make choices. You need to get early aggressive treatment for all this COVID stuff. And they can find that by going to the 10pennyalliance.org.
How do you spell 10penny?
T-E-N-P like Peter, E-N-N-Y, just like it sounds, the10pennyalliance.org. And we're going to be posting more and more things there. We've got a donate button because we're raising tons of money to be able to put clinics across America to be one of the initial people. I know there's lots of people kind of doing these things, and it's all going to work. It's all going to work. And we're going to create clinics to address early treatment of all kinds of things. So the10pennyalliance.org, they can look there. The most important place to really follow me and all that stuff is just dr10penny.com. I've been knocked off of every social media platform, as you can imagine.
Well,
so if you can
now you're back on ours.
Okay, great.
And the reason we had the conversation the way we did is there will be hundreds of thousands of people that listen to this that don't know where they fall on this kind of issue, myself included. I'm still just very curious about it. But you explained it in a very factual and very fair way and persuasive. And so thank you so much for,
you're welcome,
for
Charlie.
Coming on.
And they can find a lot of stuff like the podcast and all kinds of information. Learningforyou.org is where we have all of our courses. If
Number
people
four.
Want to do that,
yeah.
The learning, it's it, either way. It can either be FORFOR, learningforyou, YOU.org is courses. DrTenPenny.com is our podcast and all the additional information. And, you know, the TenPennyAlliance.org is where we're going to be changing the healthcare system.
Thank you so much, Doctor, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Charlie.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Email us your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. And if you want to support our show, go to charliekirk.com/support. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.